This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
I'm pleased to be welcoming Cory Doctorow to Politics and Prose tonight to discuss his new book, Walk Away. In this return to adult fiction after several successful young adult novels, Doctorow takes us on a dystopian epic. The desire to leave the superficial life of rampant consumerism often strikes many of us, and in this book, a band of renegades known as the Walkaways have followed through on that desire, braving nature and industrial wastelands in an effort to create another life. Science fiction writer Kim Stanley Robinson says of the book, Cory Doctorow is one of our most important science fiction writers because he's also a public intellectual in the old style. He brings the news and explains it, making clear the confusions of our wild current moment. His fiction is always the heart of his work, and this is his best book yet, describing vividly the revolutionary beginnings of a new way of being. In a world of easy dystopias, he writes the hard utopia. And what you know, and what do you know? His utopia is both more thought-provoking and more fun. Cory Doctorow is co-editor at the popular blog Boing Boing and a columnist for The Guardian, Publishers Weekly, and Locus. As I mentioned, he's also the author of several best-selling young adult novels, Little Brother and its sequel, Homeland, among others. Cory will be in conversation tonight with Amy Stepanovich. Amy is a lawyer and works as the U.S. Policy Manager for Access Now, which is an advocacy group dedicated to open and free internet. She specializes in laws and policies on surveillance and cybersecurity in an effort to recognize and respect human rights. So please join me in welcoming Cory Doctorow and Amy Stepanovich to Politics and Prose.
Thank you.
Hello. Thank you all for being here. A huge welcome to Cory, and thank you for being here and for having me up here with you. So we're going to start, and I actually got my phone so I can keep myself to a minimum because I have so many questions, which means I know all of you have to have questions too. So we're going to have a little bit of a conversation up here, and then we're going to turn to the audience for some questions near the end in case you do have things you want to talk to Cory about. And I want to start with kind of a broad question about the book. This is how I described it to other people, and I don't know if you intended this, but I feel like you were at least self-aware of it because you mention Ayn Rand in the book. Did you set out to write the anti-Atlas Shrugged, or have you thought about it as that?
Well, first let me say thank you to Politics and Prose and to you, Amy, for coming out tonight, and to all of you. So I think that Ayn Rand's novels illustrate the great danger of only reading one book. That there's nothing wrong with reading books, even flawed books, and even taking them to heart. The problem is not reading any of the other books. And so if this is an anti-Atlas Shrugged, at the very least, it should be a book that inspires you to read some of the other books that might help you think about it in a kind of broader, more critical context. I think that at the root of the project of the libertarian movement is an idea that people can be made more prosperous by embracing selfishness, by embracing self-interest. And that there are elements of that that actually work reasonably well. Like if you look at what kind of neoliberal economics has done for us over the last generation or so, it has lowered the material energy and labor inputs into things like cars and buildings and clothes and computers by orders of magnitude. And so if we are to have abundance, then we need to figure out ways to make things, make more things out of less things, because that way we can have more things, right? But the problem with that model is that although it works reasonably well, it fails really badly. And what this is a book about, if nothing else, is the liquidation preference of a civilization, right? What happens when things fall apart? Do your neighbors come over with a shotgun or with a covered dish? You know, and your theory about what your neighbors are going to do when things go wrong really depends on what determines what you end up doing mm-hmm. when things go wrong, because your worries about your neighbors are determine whether you can really cooperate with them well. And I think that if everyone acting in their own self-interest can produce a society that has elements of it that work well, everyone acting as though they have a shared destiny with everyone else produces a society that fails very gracefully. Mm-hmm. And in engineering, you know, we have this principle that we should think mostly about graceful failure. There are these terms of art from engineering that get really reversed in colloquial speech, but they're really useful in their original sense, and they're positive and negative feedback. So engineers assume that most systems left to their own will just accelerate until they spin out of control because they have positive feedback. The thing that works makes it work better until it just explodes, right? It falls apart. So engineers tend to look for opportunities to put negative feedback in a system. That's intelligent damping. And that idea of figuring out how to like mindfully use our technology, how to mindfully design our society so that when things fall apart, they fall apart gently. They coast to a stop that we can restart things from, as opposed to, you know, the kind of 2008 financial collapse model of just total unending catastrophe is the kind of future I'm trying to depict. And it's not trying to be predictive, because prediction's dumb. If the future is predictable, then like we should all just stay in bed because it's going to come no matter what happens. The future is contingent based on what we do. And so it's about trying to say that maybe when things go wrong, we can engineer things so that they go right again.
You talk about writing about the future, and I read this book a lot as a book about transition. Mm-hmm. Much like The Expanse on TV right now, it seems to be what happens between the now that people write about and the future that people write about. You were telling that middle story. Is that how you saw it? And as a follow-up, kind of, what did you see it being a transition from? Do you see this being a transition from this as a present, or maybe as even some alternative present where we're not living right now?
So I do think it is a transitional novel in the sense that I was trying to imagine what the world of Down and Out, the Magic Kingdom, my first novel, might look like halfway there, mm-hmm. right? What the Australopithecine version of that society might look like, you know, the intermediate state between here and there. And there's that intermediate state is often a thing that's hard to really put your finger on. You know, when we talk about evolution, we often ask, like, what use is half an eye? You know, why would evolution give you just a little bit of the power to see? Because the sight must have been refined over lots and lots of natural selection. And so I'm trying to imagine what use would be half of a utopian society that's on the outskirts of a catastrophically failing dystopian society, and how the two might exist in a kind of like temporary autonomous zone. And it's funny, it feels like there's a lot of these temporary autonomous zone stories being told, and they're really interesting. So Bruce Sterling, whose work really inspires my own, had a book out last year called Pirate Utopia, which is an alternate history of the island of Fiume, which was then part of Italy in the 1920s, but became part of Croatia eventually. And Fiume was this like anarchist commune that was also a center of fascist thought and also like a communist free state. And they all kind of lived in like non-peaceful, non-harmony. And it was, you know, pocked with bullets, and they made torpedoes. They were kind of an arms dealer to the world. And it was this like weird moment when lots of things came together. H.P. Lovecraft was there. Harry Houdini was there briefly. It was this very Robert E. Howard, you know, like it's this very strange transitional autonomous momentary bubble in which things occur. And, you know, that transience of like a better world is I think part of the lesson of the book, which is that things get better and then they fall apart, and then things get better and then they fall apart. And this is why we should pay more attention to how they fail than how they work. Making a thing that never falls apart is unrealistic, mm-hmm. right? Making a thing that where you can recover from it. I mean, it's like the old Ozzie and Harriet school of relationships, where you're just not supposed to have fights, right? As opposed to learning how to have a fight where you don't end up hating each other afterwards. Mm-hmm. You know, or maybe like DC politics were a generation ago, not to put too fine a point on it.
So I was particularly struck by your depiction of the scientists and by Walkaway University. Mm-hmm. And at one point you talk about how science doesn't necessarily always give in to power, that it can be influenced by power, but it's not going to give in to power. And I thought about that for a really long time, and I was wondering, that's very different than I think the world we live in now. Like, you have scientists, you have people who are very smart and who maybe think that they're doing really good, and maybe that's why they continue it. But they haven't reached that breaking point yet of, we're not going to do this. You know, you have emotional manipulation on Facebook. You have a lot of things just that people would say are very troubling. What do you think changes before your novel starts that makes scientists ready to walk away from their very lucrative jobs as researchers?
You know, I think you overestimate the extent to which, or underestimate the extent to which, people of technical skill, and maybe if not scientists, engineers, or people who work inside the context of the scientific method, you know, to what extent they've walked away. Like, here's a way of thinking about the contemporary project, right? Right now, if you know how to make computers do things, especially do things with data or know anything about information security, there is like literally no end to the number of recruiters who will show up and try and hire you for ever more lucrative jobs. It's actually interesting because I think it's the underappreciated element of Google's don't be evil mantra, which is that while Google's management may not really think much of don't be evil, there are, I promise you, Googlers who join the company, as opposed to any one of a number of other offers, some of which might have been more lucrative, because don't be evil meant something to them. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that there is a cost to Google of being evil. It's not that they never are evil, but they always have to count the cost. How many engineers will say, well, if I'm going to do evil, I might as well do it at Facebook. They've got, you know, nicer massage therapists. And so they you know, they, when Google does evil, then they lose some engineers, right? I the fact that that's the white hot labor marketplace of technically talented people, and yet Access Now has engineers working for it, and EFF and the Free Software Foundation and the W3C and all these other organizations that can't pay anything like these organizations do, that can't offer, even if they could never match the upside in terms of shares and liquidity events and, you know, the eventual FU money that everyone who ever gets a job at one of those tech startups is secretly dreaming of, you know, that tells you that the people do have a moral center. And I think that, like, to relate that back to this question of, like, when is the moment in which people's moral center matters? I think that is the question of our political moment. Mm-hmm. You know, unless you think that lots of people who were seemingly more or less reasonable all revealed their inner darkest natures on November the 8th, then what's more likely is that people have complicated natures, some of which are noble and some of which are shameful, and which nature dominates is determined moment to moment by, like, the extent to which you think other people will think less of you, the extent to which you think that you'll face real penalties where you might not be able to get a job, but also, like, where people might think you're a jerk and not want to go bowling with you. You know, all of those things, moment to moment, are act as a kind of regulatory mechanism on the person and on the state that the person is in, or the society the person is in. The story of only working in your own self-interest is a story that we've been telling ourselves since at least Reagan, and it's a story that cuts against that moral center. Mm-hmm. But, you know, to like go back to something we were just talking about back there and whistleblowers, how did Chelsea Manning come to do this? How did Edward Snowden, tomorrow night I'm going to be on stage with Snowden at the New York Public Library. How did Snowden come to make, on VideoLink? You're looking very confused. How did Snowden come to make this choice? And the answer is that the thing that made Snowden gung-ho, right, the thing that made him want to join the special forces, the thing that made him want to join the CIA, was exactly the same thing that drove him to go public. And that is a really powerful thing, right? And it's a thing that in the same way that Google's don't be evil mantra makes it hard for Google to do certain kinds of really bad things, in the same way America's ideals, which, you know, all countries fall short of their ideals, some countries have better ideals to fall short of than others, America's ideals has historically acted as a check on how bad America could get, because the apparatus of the state at every level has assaulted to a greater or lesser extent with people who really do believe in those ideals. And, you know, speaking as someone who migrated to this country and chose those ideals rather than being born into them, a lot of those people are migrants, mm-hmm. right? Because it an affirmative act often expresses more of a commitment than just coasting into saying the Pledge of Allegiance every morning at school.
So I have one more question about kind of where your book fits, and then I'm going to delve you into some really deep policy thoughts.
Awesome.
So going back to it being a transitional novel, a lot of what I felt you ended on was pre-Red Mars. Huh. And we started with a quote from Kim Stanley Robinson, so I thought this was particularly interesting.
Uh-huh.
What stops this from ending there?
Now we're getting into like spoilers. Let me maybe if I can answer that just by discussing briefly the relationship between the novel and Stan Robinson's work. So, because he has an outsized role in this book. So one of the things you'll note if you read this book is there's a lot of scenes in rock pools that have like natural rock pools, and that's all Stan Robinson's stuff. It's all from his novel.
I was
Pacific
really
Edge.
Jealous of all of those rock pools.
Oh yeah,
I have to say.
Stan writes sitting in a mineral bath like nobody's business, And I have always been a great admirer of Stan's novel, Pacific Edge. It's the novel I return to when I'm feeling down. I read it right after November 8th. And it's a novel about people whose drama springs not from the fact that they're all enemies who don't agree on anything, mm-hmm. but the fact that they all agree on what they should be doing and disagree on how they should be doing it. And disagreeing with your friends, you know, speaking as someone who's like been having a 3-year fight with the World Wide Web Consortium, disagreeing with your friends is really hard. It's much harder than disagreeing with your enemies. I can say all kinds of mean things about the MPAA without feeling a twinge of conscience. but disagreeing with or you know, Dick Cheney or whatever, right? But trying to square up my sincere deep admiration for Tim Berners-Lee and my sincere deep alarm at a compromise that I think he shouldn't have made, that's a really hard and dramatic thing. And you know, when I wrote Little Brother, the thing that I think that I did that was novel in the field was I wrote a techno thriller in which instead of taking computers and saying, well, these things are inconveniently realistic and, you know, they do things that it would be easier for my plot if they didn't do, and they can't do things that it would be easier for my plot if they could do, so I'll just make up a bunch of impossible computers and no one will notice. I said, what if the drama came from the actual constraints and capabilities of computers? And I think that when we tell stories about disasters, mm-hmm. you know, they say in pulp plotting, there's the two stories. There's the man versus man and man versus nature. And a lot of pulp writers like to have two for the price of one. And so, like, first your building collapses and then your neighbors come over to steal all your stuff. And so I thought, like, you know, the reality is, as Rebecca Solnit wrote so beautifully in Paradise Built in Hell, that crises are often when we rise to the occasion, when our noblest nature is expressed, when we cover ourselves in glory. What is the drama like when all of your interpersonal conflict comes from people who you like and respect and have irreconcilable differences with that make you crazy, right? Like anyone who's ever had a difficult Christmas dinner with their family knows that that is much harder than merely disliking someone, right? As they say, hate is not the opposite of love, right? Mm-hmm. They're both manifestations of the same thing. So that's part of what Stan had to do with this book. Stan has also been writing closer and closer to the metal. So he started writing with the Mars books, and then he wrote 2312, and then he wrote Aurora, which was a little closer in, and he's just wrote New York 2140. He keeps getting closer and closer to our year. It's like he started at the destination, and he's walking back towards his origin point to map the territory, to see if he can, because he can't figure out how to get from here to there, but maybe if he can figure out how to get from there to here, mm-hmm. he can reverse it and come back out again, which I really love. And the final thing Stan had to do with this was after I finished the first draft, the book was called Utopia, and I sent it to him for a quote, and he sent me a beautiful quote and also said, I have no idea why you've called this book Utopia when it's obviously called Walk Away. And he was right. So now it's called Walk Away.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a really great awareness in this novel, and there's a line that I love about different approaches to technology. Whereas when you're younger than 18, it's always been there. When you're older than 18, it's going to change the world. And when you're over 30, it's an abomination and should be banned.
Right. That's a Douglas Adams line. Yeah. I only steal from the best. Amateurs plagiarize, artists steal.
In Congress, there's of course the flip phone caucus. There are a lot of people who outright reject technology. This idea of it being an abomination, they don't hide it. They're very outwardly hostile to it. What would be your message to those people? And also on the flip side, do you yourself feel like you ever fall victim to this in your post 30 years?
Yes, those are both really good questions. So I think Congress has more than one problem with technology. So one is they fired all their experts, right? And so all the people who did technology assessment are no longer around helping them navigate this stuff. And, you know, it even if Congress were made up of young, vigorous millennials infused with a nearly mystical knowledge of the true working of social media, that still wouldn't enable them to be great experts on nuclear power and on aviation and on urban planning and on all the other things. So they need technical experts. Like they cannot have between them all enough technical expertise to be wise on all this stuff. They need to be able to assess technical advice from impartial and thoroughgoing entities. And it can't just be from lobbyists. I mean, this is a thing I've seen in lots of multi-stakeholder contexts where I was a delegate to a UN agency called WIPO. That makes copyright and patent policy, and they're like the origin of every dumb, horrible copyright law you've ever heard of. They're like they are to dumb copyright that more as Mordor is to evil. You know, it all springs from the crack of Geneva, and part of the reason for that is all of their technical expertise comes from so-called NGOs like the Motion Picture Association, Pharma, and the Publishers Association. And so they get a very one-sided view from an extremely partisan group. So that's part of Congress's problem. Part of their problem is that computers and networks are different. Most of the things that we use in our world are either special purpose and complicated, or general purpose and simple. So cars are pretty special purpose, but they're also pretty complicated. Special purpose things are like intrinsically more regulable. Like if you have a car and you're like, you know, when people talk on the phone in their cars, they have a lot of accidents. We are going to say no more car phones built into cars from now on. No one, people might like disagree with your conclusion or call it paternalistic or whatever. No one's going to say, actually, that's not a car anymore. Take the car phone out and it's not a car. What nobody says is, you know, I've noticed a lot of people drive away from bank heists in cars. Can't we design a tire that's no good for a bank heist? Because we understand that simple, general-purpose things are harder to regulate to solve our social problems, our policy problems. Computers are special-purpose and complicated. Mm-hmm. And so we have this intuition that we can say, can't you just design me a computer that runs all the programs except for the one that's causing this problem? Make me a piracy-proof computer. Make me a phone that can't run crypto that terrorists can use to hide from cops. Make me a self-driving car. Like, you guys have undoubtedly heard someone at a cocktail party stroking their chin and sounding wise and talking about the trolley problem and self-driving cars, where they say, oh, you know, in the 1960s,
this is in San Francisco, we don't do trolleys.
Yeah,
here.
Fair enough, right. But, you know, in the 1960s, there was this, like, thought experiment of ethicists that what if you were like watching a trolley barreling towards a group of people and you could push a man who was fat enough to divert the trolley into its path and kill him and spare them? When is it moral to do that? Anyway, the car version is, what if the software in your car decides that it can save people by killing you? Should your car do that? But really the question we're asking is, how do we design a car that is supposed to kill the person who owns it without keeping them from changing the software? Because, like, if you had a car that was supposed to kill you, you would reconfigure your car, right? And we don't – and, like, the fact that technical question can only really be understood when you have a little bit of a background in computer science. And the fact that that technical question has a salience wherever a policy problem has a nexus with a computer, and the fact that every policy problem now has a nexus with a computer, has created an enormous amount of congressional mischief that isn't necessarily down to the fact that they all have flip phones, and is really about like a new thing in the world, the ubiquitous, general purpose, complex, technical innovation is a really hard thing for regulators to get their heads around. Mm-hmm. So I think that Congress has like all of those problems. In terms of like my relationship to technology, am I an old fart? It's a question I often ask myself. And one of the themes of Walkaway is that like self-deception is the root of all evil. And you know that. And so I'm always worried that when I think no, what I'm doing is quite all right, I might just be kidding myself. But like, I'm a Facebook vegan, right? So I don't have a Facebook account. I don't have an Instagram account. I don't have a WhatsApp account. I eventually changed my if for those of you who are nerdy, I changed my Etsy host file so that all Facebook domains resolve to 0000 so that I can't accidentally click a Facebook link and see stuff on Facebook. And that's because Mark Zuckerberg's a creep and Facebook is a force for evil in the world. But I say that feeling like I understand Facebook and its relationship to other stuff as someone who has technological knowledge. And it's not because like I'm an old fart. It's because there's lots of other new things I like plenty well. I just don't like Facebook. And I don't like Facebook because of its formal characteristics. And those formal characteristics aren't new. They're the formal characteristics of the digital monopolists of the 1980s. Which thankfully predated the digital, singularity. And so they weren't able to get as big as today's digital monopolists have gotten. And, you know, even as beside other digital monopolists in the 21st century, you know, Google's a digital monopolist, but Google at least believes that their monopoly gets bigger when the open web gets bigger. Mm-hmm. They think their share price is keyed to the size of the open web, whereas Facebook's goal is to, like, consume and wall off the open web. And so I feel like, is that because Facebook was invented after I was 30 or because Facebook is gross? Mm-hmm. And I hope it's because Facebook is gross and not because I'm a reactionary jerk. I am open to the possibility that I'm a reactionary jerk.
So you talk about the internet. And
sometimes.
I was at an event last night and somebody told me that the best policymaking model was the model used under which the internet was invented. Mm-hmm. And that all subsequent policy models should really mimic this. And I heard him, and of course I'm reading your book, and I think back to your description of the walkaway internet.
Uh-huh.
And the fact that the walkaway internet was designed differently than the real internet. It was designed to be resilient. And there's this, I mean, not only a policy battle, but a grammatical battle going on right now about whether or not you capitalize the I in internet.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the internet or is it an internet?
Uh-huh.
Do you think that we're at a point where we should be, you know, we talk about all of the things we need to do to make the internet better. Should we be talking about whether or not this should be the only internet and if we need to build a new one?
Well, I'll tell you why we end up having the internet every time, even though we try to make on internet. We end up with the internet. And there's a anthropologist at Intel called Genevieve Bell. And one of the pieces of work she did for them was studying allegedly air-gapped networks. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, we have a hospital. And so we take all of our systems that if someone were to hack into them, everybody would die. And we don't put those on the internet. We put them on a little network inside the hospital. And you're never supposed to cross-connect it to the actual internet. Or, you know, we are a financial institution and we have these internal servers, or we are the NSA and we have these internal servers, or whatever, right? Inevitably, 100% of the time, when you walk around, you eventually find some patch panel where some person has taken a piece of Ethernet and cross-connected the two networks, or they've brought in a DSL modem, or they've brought in a Wi-Fi USB dongle, and eventually all the networks are merged into one, not because air gaps aren't good practice, but because the value, this is Metcalfe's law, the value of a network goes up at the square of the number of nodes. And so the more different ways you can connect one computer to another, the more different uses you can get out of it. And eventually, that use value just ends up trumping the concerns about the negative possible outcomes of cross connection. And so, you know, like, why did the person, and this actually has implications for information security, because a lot of information security is abstinence-based education, right? Like, I want to be able to, log into this terminal very quickly without having to change my password every 6 weeks or, remember a long password with a bunch of difficult to recall characteristics. And the answer from the IT manager is often, you only think you want that. And so at the Human Factors and Security Workshop, every year that Ross Anderson and Bruce Schneier puts on, you hear stories about what people actually do after information security people do their thing. So my favorite one is actually not from the information realm. It's armored car drivers in the UK, where there were a whole bunch of things that they weren't supposed to do, and they all broke all of those rules, right? Like, so they were supposed to wear these helmets with visors that would stop them from getting maced when they were carrying, these boxes with 50,000 pounds in and out of the banks. But there was no clip for the helmet in the car, and the car had like a corrugated steel, or the truck had a corrugated steel floor. And so the helmets would roll around on the floor, and the Perspex eye mask, the visor, would become totally opaque with scratches. And so they would never wear the visor, right? And then they had a health and safety requirement that they walk down the stairs backwards with holding their load so that it wouldn't overbalance. And so there was a rash of thefts where someone would just come up and hit them in the knee, right? And then there was like a thing where they weren't supposed to ever have more than one box of money at a time, but they put them all on double shifts. And like, these guys are all gym rats. And so because they couldn't get to the gym, they were getting their workouts by carrying five boxes of money at once. And so they were losing £250,000 at a time instead of 50,000 pounds. And it goes on and on, right? Like, abstinence-based education without reference to how people actually use technology is really, it always fails in the same way that all other forms of abstinence-based education fails. So why do people cross-connect their networks? Because they have a job to do. And if you can't figure out how to make their network secure while they're doing their job, they are not going to figure out how to not do their job. They're going to figure out how to overcome the obstacle you've put between them and their job. Yeah. And so... You know, this is why all of our internets become one internet, is because cross-connecting the internet always lets you get something done more expeditiously than not cross-connecting the internet. You want to, scan someone for a rare and exotic tumor using an expensive scanner, and you find out that the firmware that's just been released does better imaging or corrects for some false positive. And, like, technically you're not supposed to plug a USB stick into that thing with the new firmware load on it. You're just going to plug a USB stick into it because you want to check that person for a tumor, and that's immediate and important. And like, the security person has not given you a path to check that person for a tumor. And so they become the obstacle to your job and not a person who's part of your job. And so we always end up with just one internet.
So there's a part where Dis, who I'm actually intrigued that we only meet after death, talks about a project she did in life, where she figured out how to fire people who were being less productive through an algorithm. Mm-hmm. And it got me thinking about algorithms and walk away, because one of the big policy questions right now about algorithms is how discriminatory they can be.
Yeah.
Is there a place for algorithms and walk away? Because it can also be, they can be hugely helpful as well. And how are they used there?
Yeah, I mean, all the technology in walk away is built off of automated and continuously iterated process improvement. Mm-hmm. So, they have like stolen software from the UN High Commission on Refugees that's designed to build refugee camps by sending drones around to look at the ruins of buildings and figure out what new buildings can be built by scavenging that stuff and then making a plan and then showing people how to put the materials together to build their refugee shelters, except they use them to build like the fully automated luxury communist version of this, which are, big fancy hotels and tea houses and, amusement parks effectively for this life that they want to live. And in the section on that, you learn that over and over again, they refine these processes by examining how they work and seeing what improvements can be made and whether there's a new improvement. And they're included in that is trying to refine the human process. So there's this thing called network social disattention that the system tries to conjure up, which is also called the how did that get there effect, mm-hmm. where if you are told to go and put a thing somewhere and attach it in a certain way and you get it wrong and you ignore the system's warnings that you got it wrong, the person who shows up is not told that some dummy did something dumb. They are told that there is a piece of material that is misplaced. And when they get there, even though they can totally tell that you did the dumb thing, they never say, hey, dummy, why did you do this dumb thing? Everyone just kind of looks at that thing that is in the wrong place and they go, how did that get there? And then they just fix it. And this is the result of like lots and lots of iterated A-B splitting to figure out the best way to just avoid like fist fights on the job site, right? And I think that when it comes to fairness, algorithms is the wrong place to put it. Because like when you look at machine learning, algorithms are not secret. There's no algorithmic opacity. There's like half a dozen machine learning algorithms. I published a Snowden leak last year. It was GCHQ's machine learning workbook for teaching machine learning to spies doing top secret work. All of the techniques that they described are the same techniques that you will learn if you do like the Stanford machine learning MOOC. They are not secret. The thing that determines what an algorithm does is not the algorithm, but the training data. And my friend Patrick Ball, who runs a wonderful NGO called the Human Rights Data Analysis Group, has a great analogy to this. He says, imagine you had an algorithm where you could train it with the heights of people and their weights, and then you could give it someone's weight and they would predict their height. You could imagine how that would work, but imagine that you only trained it with third graders, right? And then someone comes and gets on the scales and it tries to guess how tall they are. Now imagine that you let any third grader who's self-conscious about their weight or their height opt out of the exercise, right? Now you start to get these like completely nonsensical outcomes from an otherwise perfectly sensible algorithm. So, you know, when we say, well, we want algorithmic transparency, what we really mean is we want data transparency. And not only do we want data transparency, we want the right to argue about whether the sampling methodology was adequate or whether it had some internal bias. Because it's you know, this idea that like you look for your keys under the light post because that's where the light is, not where you dropped your keys, is the thing we often use for our data models. It's like, well, we know that our cops are subject to unconscious and conscious bias, and that like stop and frisk disproportionately affects racialized people and marginalized people, and that we also can totally understand that you only ever find crime where you look for it. Like if you ask only people walking on one side of the street to turn out their pockets so you can check to see if they're carrying weed, the result of your experiment will be only people on that side of the street have weed, right? It doesn't tell you anything about whether or not that's where the weed is. It just tells you that's where you've been looking for it, right? And so we say, okay, well, we have all this biased cop data from the search and frisk, but it's better than nothing. We'll train the algorithm with it and ask it where we should go look for weed. Well, duh, it tells you to go look for weed in the place that you've been finding it all along, which is in the pockets of racialized and marginalized people because that's the only place you've ever looked, right? And so if we are to have algorithms that are effective, we need to do the thing that everybody who's ever done stats knows that you need to do, which is to have good sampling methodologies. And this is the other reason that algorithmic transparency is the wrong way to talk about this stuff, because algorithmic transparency sounds like you need to be a data scientist to get it. But like if you've ever done any statistical work, even at the undergraduate level, you had something about sampling bias. And if you just say, look, it's a sampling bias problem, everybody who has any technical background should know immediately what you mean, or at least have a sense of it. It's not esoteric in the way that algorithmic problem, you know, is that a, should you be doing random tree or should you be doing, you know, some other machine learning algorithm? That's way less important than like, is it garbage in, garbage out? Garbage in, garbage out, everyone should be able to understand.
So one more big policy point.
Yeah.
Because a lot of my work, especially this year, is on government surveillance.
Right.
And we have a huge government surveillance program potentially sunsetting this December.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of surveillance in Walkaway.
Yeah.
And then one quote that I wrote down is that you can't live like you're being observed.
Sure.
Which is very interesting in our society, because a lot of times when you work on surveillance, you get told people don't care, people have nothing to hide. And I totally reject that premise. But this idea of you can't live like you're being observed, is that defeatist? Is it indifferent? Or is it something else? Is there something else hiding beneath that?
Well, first of all, you know, computers not only give the powerful the power to surveil the powerless, they also give us something new in this earth, which is the ability to have cryptography that gives us secrecy beyond the dreams of kings and emperors not that long ago that is available to all of us. You take your pocket distraction rectangle, you briefly stop throwing pigs at birds with it, and then you take a message and you scramble it so thoroughly that, like, if all of the hydrogen atoms in the universe were turned into computers and they did nothing until we ran out of universe, but try and guess what the key was, we run out of universe a long time before we ran out of the key. So on the one hand, it's not a counsel to despair to note that that if you are being observed, it curtails your action. It's a call to action to do something. But it's also a reflection of a certain strain of self-serving BS that is intrinsic to the surveillance debate from surveillance advocates. So I remember in the days when nobody was using cryptographic tools, everyone who argued for privacy and using cryptographic tools to get us privacy was accused of being out of touch, because if people really wanted privacy, they'd be doing something about it. Privacy is more like smoking, right? It's one of these things where you make a bunch of disclosures. No one disclosure causes something bad to happen, but if you make enough disclosures, eventually they'll come and bite you in the ass, but by then it's way too late to do anything about it. So it's a public health problem, and of course people like are late to come to the party on it. But then what happened was all of a sudden people started using crypto, and the vendors, the toolsmiths, Apple and Google and whatever, they started encrypting by default. And then the same people who'd said, oh, we can tell that encryption is not a legitimate thing to want because nobody wants it, then said, encryption is not a legitimate thing to want because everybody wants it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's pretty clear that the argument was just, my life would be easier if you guys didn't want crypto. It wasn't, you know, and everything else was just you know, window dressing for this self-serving BS. So the final piece of that is that, what was the third part of your question? So it was,
is it defeated, indifferent, or is there something else behind that?
And so, yeah, the final piece of that is the recognition that people who are, that our social progress arises from people being able to choose the time and manner of their disclosures. So, you know, in living memory, within a few generations of now, a lot of things that we think of as foundational to justice were crimes and beyond the pale. So people who have interracial relationships and their children were considered beyond the pale, were considered crimes. Women who advocated for equal pay or even for the vote were considered beyond the pale. Loving someone of the same gender as you, even saying you had your gender was indeterminate or non-binary, smoking certain plants, you know, all of these things were crimes, and many of them are no longer crimes, and some of them are inevitably not going to be crimes within a little while. And the way that those things changed was not because we forced everybody who was secretly gay to fess up so that we could then all go, oh, look, all these people we like have been secretly gay all along, I guess it's all right. What happened was that people who had some secret that compromised them got to choose the time and manner of when they told the rest of their people around them about that secret, at a moment when they calculated that they could bring that person onto their side. And through those conversations that were led by the people who were at risk of disclosure, we were able to make enormous social progress. And unless you think that in 50 years your grandkids will sit around the Christmas table and say, how was it that in 2017 we had solved all of our social problems and didn't have any more changes to make in what we viewed as a legitimate way to conduct yourself, then you should really believe that out there are people that you love right now who have not yet chosen this moment to tell you about something that they suffer for, that they can't be public about. And if we don't give people the chance to decide the time and manner of their disclosure, then those people will go to their graves with those woes in their heart, those people you love. And so that part of the privacy debate, I think, is given very short shrift when we say, oh, well, if you don't have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. If you don't want to be outed for it, don't do it. It ignores that, like, there is stuff that's really dear to the hearts of the people who say that, that if they'd said it, would today be something they couldn't do.
So I'm going to turn to audience questions. There are two mics set up, and I'm going to invoke something that Corey himself did at Hope this year, which is say, to the extent possible, if you could go male and then gender that is not male in order of questions, that would be really great. So we can be inclusive of everybody who wants to ask a question. But real quick beforehand, Corey, before we got up here, I told you that my father gave me your first book 10 uh-huh. years ago. I didn't tell you that he's actually in the hospital right now.
Oh.
And I'm wondering if you couldn't look at the camera over there and just say a quick get well.
Sure.
That would mean like the world.
What's his name?
His name is Robin.
Get well, Robin.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So questions.
Yeah.
Hi, Corey. Thank you for coming again.
Thank you. Nice to see you.
I was hoping you could speak a little bit about how you get so many books done while you're still working two or three jobs, and what your work ethic is, and how you do it. What's the secret?
I like Charles Bukowski's answer to that, which is like he's got
a
pit. He said he's got a pit in the backyard. He keeps a young boy in it to write his books.
I thought that was the heart on the heart in the jar on the desk.
That's right. Yeah, that too. No, my methodology for writing and doing other stuff was perfected when I started off working at Electronic Frontier Foundation. I was traveling a lot for them, 27 days a month. Like, I stopped plugging in my fridge because I was paying $10 a month to freeze my ice cubes. And I realized that I would just have to learn to write a little bit every day. And that had been the writing advice I'd ignored for years and years. And it turned out to be the best advice that I wish I'd taken earlier, because things you do every day become habits and they just get easier and easier. And there were a couple of things that helped me make that into a habit. One, it's a dumb writer trick, but I love it, is to stop in the middle of a sentence so that you have a few words you can write the next day without having to be creative. People who know how to drive stick, which I can't do, tell me it's like parking your manual transmission on a downhill slope so that you get a bit of a roll to start you going before you have to pop in the gear. Clutch, I guess, is what it's called. The other one, though, and this was really key, was the realization that although there were days when I felt like the writing was going very smoothly and days when I felt like I was writing just terrible crap, I couldn't tell the difference 6 months later. And that the reality was that how I felt about my writing in the moment had more to do with like my endocrine levels, my blood sugar, my stress, you know, whether I was upset or happy in the wider world. And, you know, the downside of that is like the realization that those days when you think you're writing, you know, brilliant prose, it's probably no better than your average prose. And that the upside, though, was the realization that writer's block being not the inability to come up with words, but the inability to come up with worthy words that feel like words worth putting down, that you're just not qualified to judge whether the words you're coming up with are worthy or not. And so you just keep writing even when it feels like you're writing crap. And you don't let yourself, you know, you just gut it out. You gut out the unpleasant business of writing crap. What's interesting about that very stoic approach is with Walk Away, I realized that a lot of my revision techniques had been focused on taking stuff that I was already pretty good at, which is like writing very smooth sentences, and just polishing them up. So I was taking something I was sort of 95% good at and bringing it up to 95.1%. But with Walk Away, it started 60,000 words longer than I wanted it to be, 70,000 words. And I cut 60,000 words just by tightening the sentences, just by pulling out sentences, which is not a thing I'd ever really done much of, and which I found really choresome and tedious and was not fun. And unlike doing something you're really good at all day, which feels really great, it felt really boring and really awful and filled me with self-doubt and loathing. But I got super good at it. Right? And it turns out that if you take something you suck at and practice it, you get a lot less sucky relative to taking something you're good at and just sort of, you know, showing off with it. Your gains are pretty marginal. Yeah. No, thank you.
Hi. It's great to see you live. I just wanted to tell you that I went to NYU at ITP, and you have a ton of fans.
Oh, that's nice.
We got assigned, like, required reading, two of your books. I'm just like, who is this guy?
Oh, that's hilarious. Well, Clay Shirky, who helps run that program, introduced me to my wife.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
He was my mentor, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So, congrats.
Well, thank you. Oh, that was it. Oh, well, thank you. Yeah.
Hi. I read one of your books on audiobook. I think it was Homeland. Is that the one that starts at Burning Man?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, good. I got to the part where Will Wheaton is the dungeon master in the middle of Homeland.
And he's narrating his own lines?
Yeah, it blew my mind. Did you know when you were writing that you could get Will Wheaton to
Yeah, I thought, Will's an old pal of mine. I thought I could, and I really wanted him to read it. So, and I thought it'd be funny. In fact, I was partly inspired by a book by Ernie Klein called Ready Player One.
Oh, yeah,
and,
love it.
And Ernie has this funny joke that he drops in where every 5 years they reelect the president and vice president of the internet, and it's me and Will. And so Will narrated the audiobook for Ready Player One. And you can hear him when he reads his own name. And apparently he read it cold. He didn't know that it was coming up. You can hear when he reads his own name go like, Will Wheaton? And so I thought, okay, I'm going to drop it in. But the other thing I did to Will in that book was I put 1,000 digits of pi in it. And not the first 1,000 digits. Digit 100,000 through 101,000 of pi, which he only read about 10% of before the director let him off the hook. And on the Internet Archive, you can find the outtakes of both of those sequences where he really loses it reading both of those sections. Will is one of the readers on the audiobook for Walkaway, I should mention, and you can download it DRM free. As with Homeland and with Information Doesn't Want to Be Free, which Will also read, I self-produced this audiobook at Skyboat Media, wonderful studio. And it's read by Amanda Palmer and Amber Benson from Buffy and Will and Myron Willis and Justine Iyer is a big name in audiobooks. And like it came out great. Like it was mastered by a guy here in D.C., John Taylor Williams. He's an amazing audio engineer. It's a beautiful piece of work. And so it's available online, DRM free. And I should mention that I have this like new DRM free ebook and audiobook store that I've just launched. That doesn't care what country you're in. So if you're in the UK, it collects and then tells me to send 70% of the money you've given to the store to my British publisher. And if you're in America, it tells me to send it to my American publisher, but it doesn't ask you to keep track of which one is which is a real serious problem with ebooks. But the other thing is that it's the first ebook and audiobook store in the history of the world, as far as I know, that has no license agreement. So the totality of the deal that governs this book is like Congress made some copyright laws. You should obey those laws, but I'm not going to make up a whole bunch of new laws and pretend that I get to unilaterally renegotiate 5 or 10,000 years worth of our relationship to literature just because, you know, these books are now bits. So you can get all my ebooks and audiobooks and whatnot there.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Really looking forward to it.
Are there any people who identify as women or non-binary who'd like to ask the next question?
Anybody else?
We can move swiftly on to the defacement of the books, if you'd prefer. All right. Well, Amy, it remains for me to thank you very much.
You did a
wonderful job as interlocutor tonight.
I appreciate it. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks for writing this.
Aww, thank you, everyone. And thank you all for coming, and you should recognize that having an awesome independent bookstore in your town is a privilege and not a right, and it only persists to the extent that you support it.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.